ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It's that time of week. We have a guest join us. He is the author of this book, The Education of Kendrick Perkins. I want you guys to check that one out. I guess you can tell who the guest is by now. Kendrick Perkins, what's going on, man?
Bomani, my brother, how you doing, man? Hey, I appreciate you having me on, man. It's been too long.
Dude, I'm glad to have you on. And it's actually interesting to talk to you about this book about your life, because the first time I had heard about you, I want to say, is 2002, because people at my old high school told me in the round of 8 that you put them out. You put them out. Like, yeah. That was it in that year that you had put them out. So my first question is, and I ask people this when they do a book about their lives, when did you realize that your life was something that a book could be written from?
You know what? It was that transition period of when I retired from playing the game of basketball, like on the court, and when I was left in that blank space between a year and a half, you know, I was like, you know what? Like, what's next? And then all of a sudden, here comes this opportunity right now for me to come into the media. And I'm like, okay, so now I get into the media and now people are saying, oh, I'm seeing Perk a whole different. Like, I didn't know he had this personality and he was always mean mugging on the floor and things to that nature. So I'm like, okay, I'm more visible now. Now people recognize me more than when I was actually playing a game of basketball. And people have so many questions of who I am and where I came from. And everybody kept saying, Perk, you need to tell your story. You need to tell your story. So I'm like, you know what? This is the time. Like, when you drop a book, it has to be the right time. And it just felt like it was the moment right now.
Well, you just mentioned that kind of blank period, that kind of year and a half or so. So what was that like for you?
I was stressed out because I didn't retire on my terms, right? Like, I always said, I'm going to go out on my terms. I went out on their terms, meaning the phone stopped ringing. Like, I'm blowing up my agent and it's no callbacks. And it's like, hey, you want to go overseas? And I'm like, nah. Like, I did the G League and, you know, I never had the overseas in my mind. So it's like, what's next? Because I never prepared myself for what was next. And I didn't want to be that guy that just retired and all of a sudden, you know, I'm just going to just hang out around the house and just grow old. Like, I wanted to stay active. And I'm like, okay, so now I'm here. Now, what's actually next? And so I was like, you know what, let me get into coaching. And I started I wanted to be the next head coach that was a big man that played in the league, because I feel like, you know, we get overlooked. It's always the shooting guards or the point guards that get the opportunity. And so I just started tweeting, you know, about the game. And all of a sudden I get a message from Fox about, hey, you want to come on the show? I'm like, all right, cool. And then it started rolling from there.
Now, I'm always interested in that time period you talk about, though, because I think most people believe, since you got your money, that it's like, it's cool. As long as I got my money, everything's going to be okay. But the 24 hours is still 24, no matter what, right?
It's still 24. And I'm the type of person, Monty, that I'm never satisfied, right? Like, I always feel like it's more for me to achieve. And I'm going to tell you what actually got to me and was saying that, Perk, you have more and that you actually can make your next chapter of your life better than your last chapter, was Kobe Bryant. Like, Kobe, God rest his soul, him passing away, I think put it in perspective, because he actually had, I thought he was on a course of actually having a better life, a better career, should I say, after basketball than he did playing. And that's something like crazy to say, but it's true.
So I want to ask you a little bit about growing up, because I grew up in Houston. You are from Beaumont.
Yep.
And I'll be honest with you, boy, the white folks get mean to fall the east on I-10 that you go getting toward Beaumont. But Beaumont, like, relative to Port Arthur, which I think people will know that's where UGK is from and a few other people, Beaumont's the town next to it. And so for you, what was growing up in Beaumont like?
You know what's crazy is that I talked about it in my book about the culture change, and people instantly thought when I was saying the culture change from Beaumont to Boston, I was about to dive into Boston being racist, right? But it was more so about where I grew up from, me experiencing racism. Because what people need to know is we have that area called the Golden Triangle. And you probably familiar with that, where it's, you know, Beaumont, Port Arthur, Neyland, Vida, Jasper, you know, Silsbee, Orange, right? And so growing up in that area, I just remember the James Byrd Jr. Killing, right? When he was drugged on the back of that truck. And growing up, once I started driving, my grandparents who raised me, they always told me, you know, hey, look, if you're going to, you know, Lake Charles, right? Like if you're going to Lake Charles, hey, don't stop in Vida. Why not? Because, you know, Vida is racist, right? Vida is, you know, things happen to Black people in Vida and cases go cold, right? So we're taught never to stop in Vida or Neyland or slow down. Don't make sure you're not speeding. Don't get pulled over by the police. And you have to tell people why, because of the history that, you know, things that didn't happen in those places and like majority, like, you know, how segregated it really is. You look at Beaumont, it's like 60% African-American, you know, and then 40% other, where Vida is 98% white American and 2% other. And Neyland, it's the same thing. So, you know, I wanted to dive into those things and how we had to be careful and mindful about the areas that we were going to as teenagers.
Look, you're a little bit younger than me, so you may not remember, man. They were protesting in Vida to stop Black people from living in the projects.
See what I'm saying?
Projects. Like, yes. they wasn't even going for that. I remember, though, once we took, because my daddy's people from Louisiana, and we took one of those ITA road trips, and the car broke down. And we were right around there. I think we were around, was it Vida? I think, like, Winnie's over there in that stretch, too. Like, we were in all the
Yep. So when you go through I-10 and then you have that stretch that's right between Vida and Orange, Texas, right? Mm-hmm. There, it's like, yeah, it's that medium. And you kind of like, you know.
We had the car die. But the thing that was funny is that we hiked it up to the gas station and there's a Black woman came up to my uncle. I'll never forget. She just looked him up and down and said, "Who you belong to?" And we was like, oh, we in a different place, man. Like, right. And it wasn't like we were people that were unaccustomed to the rural lifestyle or even the Texas lifestyle. But we were like, oh, we in something different here.
Something different, absolutely. And you hear about all the local rappers, like they talk about it in their songs. Like, if I'm going down I-10, make sure I slow down through Vida. Like, yeah. And it's a real thing. And, you know, while I was playing and going through that transition towards the tail end of my career, you know, they had a teenage African-American boy that was found dead on the railroad tracks and the case just went cold. Like, no investigation, no nothing. He's just shot dead on the railroad tracks. And it's like, no, this is really a real thing deep down south, you know? So I wanted to dive into that and educate people about what's really going on in that area. And people instantly thought that I was going to dive into more so like, you know, it's the Boston area. Did you experience racism? And the crazy thing is, I never experienced racism in Boston. I never had a problem in my 8.5 years being there.
Now, with the, you know, growing up in Beaumont and being in Texas at that time, how much bigger was your world than Beaumont? Or was it any bigger than Beaumont? Like what you were aware of and what you were thinking about?
You know what? I wasn't aware. Like outside of AAU basketball, I wasn't aware accustomed to anything. Like, think about this for a second. I didn't know anything or a damn thing about, transporting your vehicle to another state. Like, my big dumb self actually drove 30 hours to Boston when I got drafted because I didn't know how I was going to get my truck there. I guess I got to drive. We didn't have Google Maps. So I actually had to use a road map. Like, you know what I mean? So it's, I had an outside world because I did go travel, you know, to for us with basketball. But when I got to that outside world, I still didn't know how to adapt. Like, I couldn't wait to get back home. I never left outside my hotel room. So when I did go to Vegas to go play AAU or to New York to go play AAU, it was always to the gym and back to my room because I couldn't wait for those days to go by so I can get back to living my life that I was accustomed to. And that was a country boy, and that's who I am still to this day. That's why I'm still in Texas.
Yeah, I was about to say, you left Beaumont just to go to Montgomery County. I was like, oh, brother, that ain't the play I would make. We used to play against the Montgomery County schools when I was in high school, and that was all right, man. Let's hurry up and go home. Let's hurry up and get back.
Get up out of there. You get to riding back down there on the roads, man, where those houses really separated by like, you know, half a mile, and you get to seeing, you know, those flags that are in the yard, and the people, and here's the thing. They're not hiding it, right? They're going to let you know how they feel and let you know what side of the fence they're on. So, like, it's still going on to this day, even while I'm living in that area.
Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting thing for guys like us who grow up, like, really in a particular part of the South, but especially there in Texas, where I hear people, like, Black people, when they talk about dealing with race in other places, and they, you know, like, use words like microaggression. I never dealt with a microaggression in my life. If it was an aggression, it was a macro, right? Like, and it's wild because you could have some of those people you was cool with who, like, you know, at least cool in passing, and they could say all that crazy stuff and have that thing in the yard, but if you happen to be the dude they see at whatever the place, y'all joke about it or whatever, then keep on going. Like, there's limits, but it creates a different thing. And I was actually thinking about it. It was interesting that you mentioned Boston, because I was thinking, like, going from Beaumont to Boston, I had that same thought that you just mentioned, that I think a lot of people would think about that in the context, oh man, what was Boston like? I was like, yeah, it might have actually been an improvement.
Yeah. And you know what the thing was about Boston is, when I got there, it was a culture change. I'm never saying like it was a, like, for us races, it was just, I went from eating gumbo, catfish, fried catfish and fried shrimp to eating lobster rolls and clam chowder, right? I went from not having real winters to being stuck in snow because I got these big 26 inch rims on my truck, not knowing that I should have took them off because it's potholes everywhere. And I'm accustomed to walking into, you know, a 7-Eleven or, you know, a Valero, and you passing up a stranger, and the natural reaction is you're going to speak and they're going to speak and you keep it moving. Well, in Boston, it wasn't like that. So it's, everybody was minding their own business. So you know, you passing somebody by, you may say, how you doing? And they keep it moving. It wasn't no sign of disrespect, no matter what color you was. That's just the culture of Boston. And so once I figured that out, I was like, okay, so everybody just mind their business. I'm cool with that too. I don't want to be bothered any damn way.
Hey man, what was that first winter hitting all though?
Oh, it was brutal. It was brutal. Let me tell you something. I could not wait to get back home, right? So like those snowstorms and the townhouse that I lived in, you know, they had the vents that blew the heat from the floors, right? So it took forever for it to actually warm up. You know, you set it at 85, and once you get the temperature right, you're like, hey, man, don't you open that door. Don't you open that door, because once that hawk hit, it freezes the whole room. But I never got adjusted to the windows. Like, I hated it with a passion.
You thought that coat you had was going to do something too, huh?
Yeah, that pele-pele. Well, that pele-pele, because it had the fur around the hood that was going to keep me warm. It was burning straight through that look.
Nah, that time for you, I imagine, was interesting because you came out straight from high school. Like, you were in the same draft as LeBron James, and you came out from high school. First question I always have for guys like you, where I think that people think of you as kind of, you know, being the big man and doing the dirty work, but you was cold in high school, right?
Yeah. I mean, I tell people this all the time. Hey, look, you don't go to the university. This is what KG called it, the university of cash, not putting up numbers in high school. Like, yeah, that just don't happen. Like, you don't get drafted out of high school just to become a role player. So I was putting up numbers. I had to. I mean, you know, I tell people all the time, one thing about it, I can always brag I broke all Shaq records.
And that's a basketball playing area. Like, you know, when I was in high school, that's where Steven Jackson was at Port Arthur Lincoln. So it was him, this dude Keith Harris, Emmanuel McElroy. Yep. And then what was the dude from Beaumont's name? Omar Sneed. Was the dude that was at Beaumont at the time. But that was, you know, y'all only had like 3-4 high schools for all those people, but y'all were hooping down there.
Yeah, we were hooping. And it's crazy because, like, Omar's still one of my mentors. Obviously, me and Steven Jackson got our close relationship, but you know, Stack Five, his high school coach was my high school coach. So, you know, I remember when he went overseas and he was trying to get in the league, he used to come back and he used to work out with me at my high school. So it's crazy how it went full circle. But everybody think of Texas and was thinking of Texas as a football state, right? Because they see the movies, the Friday Night Lights, and obviously they had talent come out of Texas, but they had some hoopers, man, and some big hoopers at that. You know, you see a couple 6'9", 6'10", 6'7s with skill. So, you know, I think now the goalpost is moving a little bit for us hoopers coming out of Texas and finally getting the recognition that we deserve. But it's been that way for a minute.
So as a basketball player, I always wonder about the adjustment. Well, the first question I always have for guys like you, because as I recall, you committed to Memphis when Calipari was there.
Yeah.
Did you ever wish you had gone to college?
No. And I never regret it. And here's the thing, like, and I talk about this in my book, is that, you know, I actually committed and signed with Memphis so that the colleges could stop blowing up my line. Like, I wanted to go through my senior year and solely worry about just hooping and trying to get to the league. Like, my thing is this. Why would anybody want to go to college if their goal is to actually have a career in the NBA? If you're ready to start your career and go to the NBA, why not do it? And I also say this. Nothing gets you ready like being in the NBA. I don't care if you're playing or not. I didn't even play my first 2 years. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me because I was able to learn how to be a professional. I was able to learn, you know, what I needed to do, the work I needed to put in. And I had a great group of vets. But as I got more into the league and I got towards like my fifth and sixth year, I started seeing these rookies come in, right? And so I'm looking at these rookies that went to college for 2, 3, 4 years. And they come into the league, and it was like they were starting over. And that's why people don't realize the average NBA career is 3.5, 4 years. You know why? Like 50% of the problem is that guys can't adjust to the NBA game or who they're going to be as an NBA player. They can't find their niche because everybody want to come in being the man. Just because you dropped 25 in college don't mean that this organization got plans on you being the franchise guy. But the guys who or role players and find out what their niche is, that's the guys that, you know, have the 10-plus year career and be able to qualify for that, you know, that good pension.
Well, how long did it take you to figure that out?
You know what? It took me my second year when Doc Rivers got hired. You know, Doc Rivers called me into his office, and I ain't know Doc Rivers from a can of paint. And he told me, he said, "Hey, Perk, man, listen, I'm going to keep it real with you. I didn't coach Bo Outlaw. I had Big Ben Wallace. And I'm going to tell you this. You know, you could try, and I'm not telling you not to work on your game and have goals, but you could go try and be a franchise guy, an all-star player, and it may work. But I believe that it won't work. And I believe that you may shorten your career by trying so. Or you could be an enforcer, a guy that is a hell of a low post defender, anchor the defense, rebound, and catch and finish, and you could have a long career and make you some money, and you could play 15 years if you want to. You could choose that. But I could tell it was so genuine, I took that route. I took that route that Doc told me about, and I remember the conversation like yesterday, and it's crazy because we had Doc on one day, and we actually talked about that same situation, and he remembered that meeting that we had. And that meeting right there, because I always joke with him and say, "Man, Doc, man, you know what I'm saying? You held me back, you know?" And he said, "No, I actually helped you with that conversation." But we was joking about it. That right there, I took that and I ran with it.
Was that hard to hear in the moment, though?
Yeah, because as a guy that's 20, 21 years of age, I'm looking at it and I'm watching all my peers like, you know, LeBron and CP3 and Chris Bosh and TJ Ford. I'm watching these guys get major minutes. I'm watching these guys get, you know, rookie of the year or runner up and making the rising star game and making all-star games and averaging 20 and watching their clips all across sports. And I want some of that. I want some of that. But realistically, like, was I really ever going to get to that? And I think I had to humble myself. The 2 years I didn't play, I just wanted to get on the floor. And I knew in order for me to get on the floor, when Doc had that conversation with me, that I had to do what he basically was asking me to do. And so I needed minutes, you know what I'm saying? Now, all of a sudden, I'm coming up towards the tail end of my rookie deal. So I needed to be on Doc Best's side, but it ended up working out the best for me.
Now, you talk about adapting to the NBA game. What was it like for you at 18 years old adapting to that NBA life?
You know what? It was easy. It was easy because I had the right vets. And Monty, I tell everybody this, right? It all depends what organization you go to, right? Because I had a great group of veterans, like old school. Like when I got to the league, these guys 9 years in, 11 years in, 12 years in. I'm talking about Tony Delk, Tony Battee, Eric Williams, Walter McCarty. So they taught me like, hey, young fella, you tripping. Like, young fella, like, nah, like you need to, you know what I'm saying, be the first and the last one to leave the gym. Like, you punching in that clock? You on that, you getting that extra 20 minutes on that exercise bike? Like, where your body fat at right now? Like, you know, like they'll catch me eating something on the plane, be like, nah, you can't have that. Like, you got to have that discipline. So it was them teaching me and I actually showing me and me listening to them saying, man, shoot, we got a big one tomorrow, man, we'll get our rest. Or young fella, look, we plan on stepping out tomorrow night because we're going to be off the next day if you want to come out. Like, and they started teaching me the ropes slowly but surely, and I just was like a sponge. I just kept soaking it all in because, you know, I wanted to be there. Like, I wanted to be in the league. And so this is not throwing no shade like at, you know, Marcus Banks, who him and I was drafted together, but he actually was that rookie that had a hard head. You know what I'm saying? Like he you would call his phone and his voicemail would be, you have reached a voicemail of, and it would say, I am him. So he had that approach already. So the best didn't really mess with him. But I came in with that humbleness and that countryness and I was cool. And they just, man, they just kept giving me knowledge, knowledge, knowledge. And Danny Ainge was on me about just like life stuff, man. He was on me like I went and bought some earrings and a chain. He was like, what are you doing? Like, that you're not a man's man. Like, my center around here dressing up all cute. Like, what are you doing? Like, why are you spending your money on that, man? Go get some fake ones if you're going to do it. Like on me about that type of stuff. And it helped. It helped for real.
Now, your fifth year is when Kevin Garnett showed up. And when was the moment that you realized that that dude was just a little bit different?
It was the first day of training camp. The first day of training camp because we had a meeting before we went out on the floor. And that showed how unselfish he was because in that meeting, he said, you know what? Now, we all knew that KG was the best player on that squad. No disrespect to Paul or Ray. And I remember in that meeting, he was like, you know what? I'm going to take a back seat, man. We're going to run this offense through Paul and Ray. And Doc, if you need me, I'm here. But Perk, me and you go worry about anchoring this defense. I'm like, all right, cool. You know, like, it's whatever. But it was the work that he put in. Like, KG never missed a day of weightlifting. Like, back-to-backs, somehow we on the road. He got the equipment out of their room in the hallway hitting his weights. Like, he never missed his massages. He never missed that extra court work and time and things of that nature where I would just catch myself just sitting down, just watching him. Sometimes I would join him, but I just wanted to watch him. Like, and it wasn't half speed. It was game speed where he's lathered up even more. He got to get a whole nother shirt. And I'm like, see, this is why he's him. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is why he's him. And he wasn't afraid to call people out. And he wasn't afraid to let people hold him accountable as well.
Yeah, the funniest thing about him from a distance, at least, is he's like that all the time. Like, yeah. The idea, like, you get those people, you're like, oh, wait, no. This dude is really crazy like this about all the time.
In real life. He's really like that. Great dude, but he's throwed off, and that's okay. We all got flaws, but great dude, but that's who he is. And it takes a while for him to trust you. Like, to really let you in and him embrace you with open arms, it took KG almost like, you know, 2-3 months before he even let somebody like really into him, like, you know, like really, really into his comfort zone. And I think it had to do with a lot with his upbringing. But once he gets you in, man, that's like the, one of them friends, them partners that you never, ever want to lose in life. Like, that's a bridge that you never want to burn. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's one of them loyal ones. Like, you don't find them often.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that championship season, because the thing about it was, y'all weren't good. And then the trades happened, and now suddenly you were the best team in the NBA. So, like, what's it like adjusting for you? Because I always worry about those young dudes who take a lot of losses early, because you get, you know, like, that gets into you, and now all of a sudden, not only are you good, but the expectations are high. Like, it's not like you're an unexpected good.
Well, you know what's crazy is that when it first happened during the summertime, I didn't give a damn. Like, I actually was pissed off about it, because I thought that Al Jefferson and myself was about to be the power forward in the center in the future for the Celtics. And it hit me, because I was actually on the phone crying to Doc, like, man, why we had to trade Al, man? Like, we couldn't have waited for this, like, give us one more year. And he was like, Perk is done. Man, you know, I don't think you realize what's going on. I'm going to miss Al, too. And I'm like, man, I ain't trying to hear that. I'm not even locked in on that I actually could be the starting center on the team playing alongside KG and go win the championship. Until, you know, the next 3 days, I'm watching SportsCenter and ESPN, and all of a sudden, it's like the Celtics' favorite to win. And what ended up happening was that all you kept hearing about is the big three, right? Rightfully so, the big three. But then you start hearing about the concerns. Okay, well, who's playing the center? Is Kendrick Perkins really ready to play the center? Is Rajon Rondo ready to play the point guard? So while all the attention kept getting shined on the big three, it drew me and Rondo close together. And so we started calling ourselves the other two. Like, we started just hanging out, us two, but we also started getting extra work in. We also started getting with the coaches and watching film. And so we had a chip on our shoulder the whole season that nobody knew about, that we wanted to prove people wrong, because we was like set up to say, like, if it didn't work out, we was going to be the one shipped up out of there and blamed. So when you saw Rondo and myself elevate our game in the postseason, it's because that's how we carried ourselves the entire season. Like, we was the other two, and we would hold each other accountable. Like, hey, man, I'm going to see you at the gym at 9. I ain't coming to the gym. Yeah, you coming. Or it was vice versa. So that's what got us through. Us two together, because we was on that team that sucked the year before, that lost 18 in a row.
Yeah, I thought Doc was going to tell you sad about Al getting traded. You need to be glad it wasn't you.
Like, right.
That's one of those that could have gone either way.
Yeah, but I don't think Kevin McHale wanted to get me over Al Jefferson, not the numbers he was putting up at the time.
No, I had not really thought about it until you said it. Y'all were in Boston with the country's low post that we have ever had, with you and Al Jefferson out there at the same time.
Yeah. Prentice, Mississippi, and Beaumont, Texas. Al used to stay across the street from me. He never wore socks or tennis shoes. He used to come across it barefoot. I'm like, man, is you good? Yeah, you know, Prentice, Mississippi, you know, one stoplight. I went out there to visit him one time. One stoplight, population of 900 people. And he lived like.
Now, you know, you had that time with KG and those guys. And then basically for the rest of your career, you played with like a top 75 or two player for the rest of your time. You were there with Durant, with Westbrook. You had the short time with Harden. You played with Anthony Davis. You played with LeBron James. So, like, is there any, like, common through line that you've seen between those guys that you played with?
Well, you know what? It was different for all of them. But the most important thing is that I saw from all those guys, I played with 11 Hall of Famers, right? All those guys put in the work. Like, KG put in the work in a different type of way. Paul did the same. Ray, we used to land in cities, and he would go run 5 miles no matter what time it was, right? And then I saw Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook and James Harden when I got to OKC, and I remember it was like 3 days after I got traded, and KG hit my phone like, what's up, bro? Like, you ain't gonna holler at us? Like, you know what I'm saying? You ain't responding in the group message no more. I'm like, listen, man, I'm trying to get adjusted over here. And the first thing he hit me up and said was the next thing that came out of his mouth was, hey, how them young fellas is like that? And I was like, bro, these dudes ain't playing no games when it comes to working on their craft and being in the gym. Like, I'm watching KD before practice after a back-to-back. First of all, we're practicing after back-to-backs. That was the first thing that got me blown away, because back-to-backs in Boston, the day was off. So I'm watching KD, like, you know, go through triple teams with coaches and work on his game. I'm like, this before practice. After practice, he doing it again. We were laying in cities, and he would already have a middle school or high school lined up where he was going to get extra work in. And then all of a sudden, I get on the team with LeBron James, and I'm like, hold on, man. This dude's schedule really like the president. Like, he's waking up at 5. He's working out before practice. He's getting to practice. He's working out with guys. He's practicing. He's getting another workout in. He may go to a commercial, go shoot for 3 hours. We may go to dinner, and he's there. He's getting treatment while we're in the 5-star steakhouse, and he got his guy getting treatment. We got ice and stem on his knees, legs, and everything else. And I'm sitting up here saying, people don't understand what this is. Like, I'm looking at his whole routine and why these guys are great. And I talk about that in my book. Like, each guy, I talked about it, and I got to witness greatness. And I ain't taking for granted. Like, I got to see Gary Payton and what he done. I got to see Kevin Durant, LeBron, KG, Paul, and Ray. And why these guys are who they are today, and why they in the Hall of Fame, and why they some of the greatest players to ever touch the basketball.
Well, with all that work, especially with those guys in Oklahoma City who got up to speed fast, how frustrating did it then make it the way those three games in Miami went in 2012?
Well, you know what? To be honest with you, I wasn't even frustrated because I knew that we wasn't going to win that series. And I'm going to tell you why. The way that we celebrated after we won the Western Conference Finals and we beat the Spurs, I could see the drop-off, and I could see guys kind of like let off the gas a little bit. Not saying that they didn't compete, but the sense of urgency wasn't there. And we was going against a veteran ball club that had just got knocked off and was on the verge of trying to, you know, that big three was trying to win their first title. And I already could sense it. And so, you know, that's what I always say. It's just like, it's like boxing. Like, sometimes, you know, you have those young fighters that come in and they have that big box office fight against Floyd Mayweather. He didn't been there already. You know, so he didn't experience that whole Vegas treatment and the 2 weeks building up to the fight. Like, your mental gotta be prepared for this. So when you walking into shoot around or practices and you got 1,000 media people on the floor, and that thing come up before a jump ball and it's NBA finals and it dropped down, you can get caught up in the moment. Like, if you can get caught up in the moment if you haven't been there before. And we just witnessed that last year. That's why Golden State beat the Celtics, because they've been there before. They didn't get caught up in the moment. They didn't get caught up in realizing that they were in the NBA Finals.
Man, I think it was game 4. Steph had this moment. I just remember they showed it on camera. I forget what play he made, and he did one of these right here afterwards. Yep. And I was like, oh. This is over.
Light-skinned brother with the green eyes. Straight up.
Like, he had decided, I didn't know he had it in him like that, the we've had enough, right? Like, you know, players of that caliber can just come out there and make a decision at points. Like, nope, we have had enough. This has got
to stop. I'm not waiting on nobody. I'm taking over.
Now, this latest chapter of your life has been interesting for me because I'm good friends with Nick Wright at Fox. And I remember you had made the comparison when you first started doing this about Kawhi Leonard and Michael Jordan. And as I thought about it, I was like, yeah, that's the truest one. And Nick had told me, he was like, hey, man, Perk hit me up because he feel like people been taking his line about Kawhi and Michael Jordan and not giving him the credit that he deserves for it. And it dawned on me. I was like, oh, you taking this serious. Like this is like you. A lot of people come into this job and just like, hey, it's a way to make some money. But you came into this taking this real serious from the very beginning.
I did. And you know why? Because I had regrets. I still got regrets. I had regrets of what I didn't do when I was playing and some of the off seasons I didn't put as much into my craft as I should have, right? Like, I'm not saying I could have been a better all-star caliber player, but I could have extended my career. I could have made more money. I could have added about 3 or 4 more years, and I have regrets about this. So when I came into this opportunity right here, I was like, no, I'm not having regrets in this. Like, I'm about to put my all into it. If I got to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning for a production meeting, then that's what I'm going to do. And I remember that was my first time ever doing a car wash. And I said that on the get up when I was on there with Greeny. And I said, you know, Kawhi Leonard game, mimics Michael Jordan. And people's like, man, Perk, how I get him off the TV tripping? I didn't say he was Michael Jordan, but if you watch him, then all of a sudden later on, guess what we start seeing? We start hearing, you know, Kawhi college coaches and people in his camp start saying how he watched so many of Jordan clips. And then all of a sudden you start watching Kawhi get to his spots in the mid-range, turnarounds over both shoulders, the way he was palming the basketball, those long arms with the big hands, like it mimicked Michael Jordan. And so, you know, I take it serious. I say that to say this, you know, in this career, I'm like, okay, I'm fortunate to be here. Well, I wasn't a Hall of Famer. You know, when the Hall of Famers finish their career, man, they, you know what I'm saying, they roll the red carpet out. You look at Tom Brady right now, he got close to 400 waiting on him right now. But it's not like that for a guy like me that was a role player. So when I came into it and this opportunity kept getting bigger and the door started opening up even more, I'm like, I got to take advantage of this. Like, why I can't make this next career better than my first career? Like, I shouldn't have no regrets.
Did you have any concern getting on TV sounding how you sound? And it's not to say there's anything wrong with how you sound, but they normally tell us from where we at right, not to sound the way we sound. But you sound like you, right? And that's one thing I've always, like, greatly appreciated. The thing I love about Marcus Spears also is, like, you understand what I'm saying. Like, I don't have to pretend to sound any other way. Did you ever have any apprehension about that, though?
Man, I did. You know what? At first, I'm like, man, let me sit up here and, you know, get my vocab up and going into the dictionary. And I'm sitting up here saying, man, this ain't me. Because as soon as I got on set, you know, when they get to count you down, you got 30 seconds, you know what I'm saying, to get whatever you need to get out. I'm like, I might as well just be me. You know what I'm saying? And I started taking, you know, who I am. I'm go talk slow. I'm go talk with broken English. But you get what the hell I'm saying. And we talking basketball. Damn it, this ain't English class. We talking basketball. And so I started taking that approach. And then all of a sudden, I started taking those old school lines, man. You know, when you sitting at the spade table or domino table with them old heads and they get to hitting you with them punch lines. And I'm like, okay, how can I put this into this game or put this into what I'm about to break down? And I started taking these bars and putting them into my vocabulary, and people started saying, man, Perk crazy. We come up with that. He's so country. And then all of a sudden, it took a while for people to get adjusted to me. But when they did, they like, man, we love what Perk bringing to the table. And that just gave me more fuel to continue to be myself.
Yeah, and you figured out something I tell people all the time about doing TV, radio, anything else. You only capable of thinking about one of these two things. You're either going to think about what you're saying or how you're saying it. You can't think, you can't do both at the same time. Once you try to do both at the same time, that's when you stumble over yourself. That's when everything comes out. Like, you just gotta, if people understand what you're saying, they'll be all right. They can handle it.
Yeah, they'll be all right.
Now, one thing you've talked about online and is also part in the book is, you know, you as father. And one thing I want to talk to you about, like, specifically with fatherhood is you're a basketball dad now, right? And so now you're going to these AAU tournaments and you're seeing everything that's going around. What's different from when you were playing to your son's playing now?
Everything. And it's really hard to be involved, but I have to, right? Because I want to, because of my sons. But to be honest with you, man, if my children wasn't playing, money, I wouldn't even go in there. Because it starts with the parents. The parents believe that their child is the superhero and is the best thing since sliced bread. Like, and they're telling these kids that instead of telling these kids the truth, right? So you got all these kids that are on one team that is trying to lead the team in scoring, and your kid is not that talented, but you're not telling your kid that he got to continue to work and just play his role. And now all of a sudden, you know what happens? All of a sudden, you see one kid then switch 5 AAU teams in 2 years. Because his parents just trying to find that team where he could be the man, thinking that's what's going to get him ahead. And then now you have these coaches, right, who rushing to get into these pitchers on the front of the pitchers to post with a trophy to say, oh, I went and recruited 100 kids from, you know, 20 different states, and I didn't form your organization. Well, you should. I mean, damn, you got all the top-tier players. You should win, right? And so – they go get them, and these coaches want to make a name and make it all about themselves. So now you see all these coaches and you see these guys that's running these organizations, now they hopping on live, and now all of a sudden they just, you know, brain, they the ultimate guys for us basketball talk, and it just makes my skin crawl. And it's this last tournament, and I don't know, they probably did, but almost 90% of the tournaments that I've been going to since my son's been playing, it's been a fight with parents, or a fight with referees, or a fight with coaches. And it's crazy. We didn't have that. Like, we wasn't having it when we was going to the gyms. Like, it was peaceful. Half of the time, you know, when I was going, my team was going, it was only two parents traveling with us, right? Because majority of the players that was on my team came from single parent households, and parents wasn't involved like that. Social media is killing it. You know what I'm saying? Because everybody want to rush home and post their clips. And I don't mind it, because I do it with my kids, right? But I ask their permission to see if they want to be on there. Because I have to teach my kids, they have to have a different mindset when walking in the gym. Because you're going to have people that's going to say something about your dad. You have people that's going to say something about you, whether you balling or not. So you got to be able to withstand it. At the end of the day, you're not losing no sleep. If I'm not bothered, you shouldn't be bothered. But the AAU world is terrible right now. Matter of fact, Steve Kerr spoke about it. And he said something about it, I think, about last week. It's an article out there, and he was just saying how like, you know, bad the AAU basketball is. And it's not because it's the talent, but it's because it's the adults that's messing these kids up.
Yeah, they getting a lot of grown-ups getting their chance to be part of the action, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah.
Being a coach matters in this world. Like, you say you were coach, people kind of perk up, and now these cats get to cosplay that. And like, it's like fantasy camp in a lot of ways. And the thing I wonder, though, with AAU at this point, do kids need to play all this basketball, though, right? Because I think that's part of the load management discussion is, man, cats got a lot of miles on them coming in. And like, I forget, when I looked up and saw something once when kids were playing in May, like high school teams were playing in May, I'm like, dude, school ain't even in.
And you know what's crazy is that when I was playing AAU basketball went from the last weekend of April to like the last week or the middle of July, and it was done. Now it's year round, and I'm sitting up here saying, like, you know, you have 9-year-old teams and 8-year-old teams. They are traveling every single weekend to state, chasing rankings and chasing all this. And I'm sitting up here saying, like, nobody gonna say nothing in y'all organization. No parent gonna step up and say this ridiculous. Like, what are we doing? But it's chasing it. It's chasing it. It's for own individual reasons or self reasons. It's ridiculous, man. I'm telling you straight up.
And people don't know, I try to make this point, that you go through like the recruiting rankings year by year, it's like 20 dudes in America that become legit NBA players every year. Not just a guy that gets on a team, right? But becomes a legitimate NBA player. Like, you were a top 5 recruit and you had a very good career. But I bet if you come around now, people are expecting zillions and zillions of dollars coming from you. That wasn't going to be the case. And it's not because you wasn't good. It's because, man, what we talking about is really, really hard. And I feel bad for those kids that ain't that good, whose parents are under the mistaken impression that boy going to go to the NBA somehow.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm going to tell you, they have these sites now that do these individual rankings. And like, every chance I get, if I see my, because they put my 11-year-old son on there, every chance I get, I go in there and come and say, take my damn kid off for this. Like, it's ridiculous. You damaging these kids, because, you know, you could have a kid that's 10 years old and you sit up here and you rank him number one in the country, and 2 years from now, he not even ranked. All of a sudden, you didn't damage this kid for life. And then explain to me, how the hell you ranking 10-year-olds anyway? Are you seeing enough of basketball, enough of their games to rank a kid or rank kids? And why are you ranking kids? Now, when you get to the 9th, 10th, and 11th grade, I understand, right? The rankings and stuff like that. You know, you could go ahead and do what you do, but ranking kids that are in grade school, it's flat out ridiculous. And at one point, when I first started, when my sons first started AAU, I actually got caught up in the moment, because when I had been so far away from AAU, I'm thinking the rankings and all this, and I had to catch myself. I'm like, man, what the hell am I doing? And I started just jumping the other way with it.
Now, my homeboy's got a son who was a top 10 8-year-old in the state of Georgia, which was a mind-blowing concept. And now the boy's in high school, and he's good. Like, I think he's going to wind up going, and they figured out, like, for example, they made sure you're just not doing all basketball. Like, he was playing water polo and stuff like that, you know, to kind of get the variety on it. But all these grown-ups found ways to get clout and money off of this, and that's the worst thing you could ever say about something involving kids.
Yes, yes. And they, and that, like, they didn't hit me up asking, hey, man, I could write an article about your son. It's going to be $100. I was like, man, I wish I would pay you $100 to actually write an article about my son. You must be out your damn mind. I don't care about no damn article about him.
Somebody tried to charge you to write about your son?
That's what they do, man. It's ridiculous right now. But, you know, still in all, I could tell you this much. Outside of that, the competition is there, right? The competition is there. And it for my kids, it puts them in the trenches, in the ringer. Like, let me see what you made of, right? Like, people, you walking in the gym, people automatically think you a spoiled kid. Let me see if you know how to go get it out the mud. How you go handle this?
Last question for you. Will you ever let your son beat you in basketball?
Nah, I don't let him beat me right now. Straight daddy ball. Look, they get it. They think they, man, I'm going straight to the post. If you catch your elbow, it is what it is. Because it's going to become a point of time where they might can beat me. But guess what? I'm going to tell them I can't play them.
You're just putting your back on your 11-year-old and saying, do something about it.
Yeah, do something about it.
Hey, man, that's Kendrick Perkins. The book is right here, The Education of Kendrick Perkins. Definitely be sure to check that out. But, man, I've been glad to watch you as you get better at doing this job, man, and working at it. So I'm glad you got the book out. I'm glad for all the success you've had on this, man, and I appreciate you joining us here.
Man, I appreciate you, man. I appreciate everything that you do, man. I'm a huge fan, man, and I love the way that you deliver everything, your messages, your point of views. You come across as you. You come across as being real, man, and I appreciate you, man. Continue to keep being you.
Hey, man, I appreciate it. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this 3 times a week. Got Sarah Abbott helping us behind the scenes today. Thank you, ma'am. Remember, and also thanks for watching us on YouTube. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.